Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, we do keep it rocking here on the West Coast because we know how to party. There ain't no party like a West Coast party because a West Coast party don't stop. What's going on, everybody? Thank you guys for tuning in to yet another episode of Inside the Octagon. I'm your host, Kalani Lua. You guys can find me on social media via Twitter at KLua11, that's KLUA11. Also, you guys can follow my sports page on Facebook, All Things Sports. That is All Things Sports on Facebook. This episode of the Inside the Octagon is brought to you by the Sports Career Podcast, which you guys can tune into every Thursday night from 6 to 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Be sure to tune in for the latest in football, college, and the pros, basketball, college, and the pros. We're throwing some baseball here and there, some other big news that's going around the sports world, but that is the Sports Crib every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Yowza, man, oh man, speaking of the West Coast, this past Saturday, UFC on Fox was live from Sacramento, California. And man, oh man, was this a very good card to tune in. So I hope everyone got a chance to get out there and check out the good fights. If you didn't, I got you covered, so no worries. Headlining the card, we have Michelle Karate Hottie Watterson taking on Paige VanZant. Co-main event, Mickey Gall and Sage Northcutt. Uriah Faber calling into career. Against Brad Pickett and Alan Jouban, taking on Mike Perry. And go over just the main card real quick. Let's start at the top with the main event. The two female strawweights going at it. Michelle Watterson taking on Paige VanZant. Two up-and-coming fighters, I guess you can say in a sense. Obviously, Paige certainly is one herself. Michelle Watterson certainly is no rookie in her own right, but she is new to the UFC. It's been over a year since we've seen the Karate Hottie in action. She did suffer a knee injury last year in training, so she did have to take some time off of that. But looking to make a big splash and a comeback to the Octagon, looking to definitely cement her name in the top of the women's strawweight division to say, hey, you want a young J-check, hold on to that title a little bit longer because I'm coming for you. Paige VanZant looking to show people that she's more than just a smile and a couple of nice victories early in her career, bouncing back from her loss to Rose Namajunas and her highlight reel knockout finish of Beck Rollins earlier. She is certainly showing the goods. Michelle Watterson, though, was just a little bit too much for 12-gauge. And, look, this was a good fight, highly anticipated. The weigh-in was pretty entertaining, one of the best ones we've seen. They had a nice little dance-off with each other, so that was entertaining to see in its own right. But to the fight, Karate Hottie was able to go in there and use what she's known for, her range, her movement, her sidekicks to keep opponents at bay. She would come in with a nice overhand right to whenever Paige could get past her kicks to let her know, hey, you get past the kicks, here comes the fist. And Paige, you know, she was coming out in her typical form, looking to press the action, come forward. One thing that you notice, and I was very surprised by this, is you would think that the advantage in the clinch game would go to Paige. She's bigger, younger, and that's really her forte. We've seen her time and time again really go out there and have her way in the clinch game with a lot of her opponents outside of Rose Namajunas. But in this particular one, Michelle Watterson was able to capitalize in the clinch game and really take advantage of it. Perfect example was one of the things that Paige VanZant likes to do is whenever an opponent grabs her back, what Paige likes to do is kind of let you come closer, let you grab her back. But she does that because she looks to throw her, either her left or her right arm back over your head, get you in kind of a standing headlock, and hip toss you, kind of like a judo throw. Or if she could grab one of your arms, get a nice good grip on it, wrapping one of her arms around your elbow, securing the wrist. She likes to throw her hips back at you while throwing her shoulders forward, and that will cause you, with your momentum, already coming in to grab her by the back, go forward, you go for a ride. Now you're on the ground, she's generally on top. That's what Paige likes to do. When she did try for this, though, you can see Michelle Waterson very much scouted this move out, and she countered it very, very nicely. Gets a nice takedown from the back position, And really, she was able to secure a very nice body triangle on her. For those that are unfamiliar with the body triangle, it's where you take one of your legs and you wrap one of them, you wrap your calf basically across your opponent's stomach. And then you take your other leg and you throw it over, you throw the back of your knee part over your ankle, locking them up, almost like a figure four for those of you that are wrestling fans, or a head triangle for those of you that are familiar with that in the world of jiu-jitsu and MMA. So, but you throw it around the body, very, very tight, very uncomfortable, makes it hard to breathe, very hard to move, and one of the toughest ground positions to be held in to escape. So once Michelle Waterson was able to lock in this hold on Paige VanZant, she really had control over from there. And, it was just a matter of time. She's doing a rear naked choke, gets the submission. Paige did not tap. She did not tap. She blacked out before she tapped. Only for a mere moment, she didn't do one of those drool moments or seeing stars or punching in the sky. No, she kind of just, she was trying to push her arms off, trying to move her hand, and then you just see her hand go limp, like, ugh. And it just didn't turn out from there. So Karate Hottie gets the first round submission via a rear naked choke 3 minutes and 21 seconds into the round. Very good for her. Again, for someone who had been gone from the sport for well over a year, coming back against a very energetic, high energy output fighter like Paige VanZant, really does show that Michelle Waterson, she is the real deal. She certainly is here to stay. And look, afterwards, she said she wants to get back in the octagon as soon as possible. Whether that means a quick date as far as January or February, we don't know. But she certainly does want to get back in there. Very quickly. I'll get to when she could possibly get back in there, or at least when I would like to see her back in there momentarily. But one thing after the fight that I did not like that Michelle Waterson did, and really what a lot of fighters do, is not only in the cage when Brian Stain gave her a post-fight interview, but then the post-fight scrum when she was on UFC on Fox, and she was on the panel with John Anik, Dominic Cruz, and Daniel Cormier. Cormier did everything he could to not only ask, but to get Michelle Waterson to call out a fighter. You know, you say what you will about where you stand on guys like Conor McGregor, but one of the reasons fighters like Conor McGregor are so popular and they get the big fights and they bring in the big numbers is because they understand the art of entertainment. They understand the art of having an opponent in mind, calling them out. I've said this time and time again. If you don't care who you fight next, why should the fans? For all the fighters who just say, hey, well, who's next? Who do you want to fight next? Oh, I don't know. It doesn't matter to me. Whatever UFC wants. You know what? The only time you should be saying that is when you're the champion. Other than that, you should always have somebody in mind that's in front of you, or if you have a personal vendetta against somebody that you want to face. This idea of, I'm not going to call anybody out, you know, I'm just going to take it one fight at a time. Well, duh, that's how combat sports work. Were you taking it two fights at a time before? Three fights at a time? It's like people that say, oh, I'm just taking it day by day. Well, yeah, no shit. That's how we all take it, day by day. What were you doing, week at a week? Month by month? Well, I mean, what, 60 days by 60 days? 35 days by 35 days? What were you doing beforehand? So you really have to invest in yourself. You really have to promote yourself. You have to have that self-confidence and that belief that anybody that's in front of you is not worthy and that you're better than every single person on that roster, and you're willing to prove it and go out there and put on the show for the fans. That's what gets you into it. In the co-main event, we have Mickey Gall. One of the reasons Mickey Gall is in the UFC and was the co-main event of this card was because guess what? He's called out guys. When he was on Dana White looking for a fight, which you guys can check out on YouTube on UFC Fight Pass, he gets a win on there. He calls out CM Punk. Says, hey, he wants to fight in the MMA. I want to welcome him to the UFC. What happens? Dana White brings him to the UFC. He beats CM Punk. What does he do? He calls out Sage Northcutt. Now look what he got. He got a match with Sage Northcutt. You have to be willing to invest in yourself. And I was very frustrated because, as I said, Daniel Cormier, say what you will about your personality or his fighting style, he's a very good analyst. And when he gives interviews, he really does make sure that when fighters come on there, that he tries to do everything he can to pull, to claw, to scratch an answer out of them. Not the basic plan, oh, well, you know, whatever the organization wants. No, he tries to get a name out there. And he even told her, if you want to fight, this is the platform where you do it. This is where when you call out somebody, 9 out of 10 times, the UFC will not only look into it, but will do what they can to make the fight happen. Michelle Waterson was not biting for it. Now, I understand. Look, I'm not saying everyone needs to be like Conor McGregor, Nate Diaz, Chael Sonnen. You don't need to go full WWE promo here. You don't. But to go out there and to say, hey, I want to fight this guy, what's wrong with that? Or lady, what's wrong with that? That's not going scripted promo. That's not going, oh, it's becoming too much like pro wrestling. No, it's not. Hey, who do you want to fight? I want to fight, you know, John Doe or Jane Doe. This is who I want to fight. Well, if I'm ranked number 11 and I just beat someone that's number 8, I want to fight number 7, number 6, number 5. That's what I want to do. Give me somebody in the top 5. Give me somebody in the top 3. Or hell, just keep it simple. Always call out the champion. Don't matter what your rank is, call out the champion. I want the champion. I want the belt. I have, look, just like pretty much 100% of you, but I'll just say 99.9% of you listening, just like, you know, I'm not a professional fighter, but I've always said that if I could train a fighter or if I knew a fighter who I could have their ear or if I was a fighter myself, one of the things that I would always do when in interviews is I wouldn't necessarily talk about a fighter, but I would talk about just a belt. And I would make it to where that's what I'm coming after. Because at the end of the day, that belt could change hands at any point in time. You just don't know. So to call out the one specific champ, and that's good too, but then you never know. But then think about this. If they say, hey, Kalani, you just won a fight, congratulations. What's next? I want that title. I don't care who's holding it. I want that belt. I'm coming for that belt. No, whether or not it's a current champion or a future champion, no matter who it is, everybody be warned. When you're wearing that belt, not only do you have a target from everyone else in this division, but I'm coming for you. No matter when it happens, when it does, there's nothing you're going to be able to do to stop me because I'm going to be way too good for you to hold me back from completing my destiny, from fulfilling my dreams, from going after what I'm chasing. That's what I'm going after. So beware. Enjoy it now while you can. Take all the selfies and all the Instagram posts and all the Snapchats you can with it. Do all the media press you can with it. Get as many pictures with it as you can. Let everybody in your family hold it because there's going to come a day where I come up there and I'll take it from you. And when I do, I'm not giving it back. So what's wrong with that? That's not a WWE promo. That's not you trying to be like Stone Cold Steve Austin or Hulk Hogan or Roddy Piper. That is you going out there telling everybody what we all know you all want, you know, in any sport, boxing, MMA, pro wrestling, football, basketball, whatever. If you are not out there to win a championship, then what are you there for? If you're not out there to become the best, then what are you fighting for? And again, you know, Michelle Waterson, she put on a great performance, looked very well. I'm not knocking her performance. I'm just knocking her and many other fighters who choose not to promote themselves, not to engage, to draw interest in their future fights. One of the reasons Demetrius Johnson, who's the pound-for-pound number one fighter in the world right now, one of the reasons he could never be a big draw in the UFC, even though he's tied for second all-time with George St. Pierre on consecutive title defenses, and it's not even close for the guys that he's facing, is because his personality is like a plain bagel. You know, it's like a toasted bread, but with no butter, no cinnamon, no jam. What the hell? I toasted the bread, and okay, that'll work, but I'm not going to put anything on it, no fruits, no spread. What the hell? So, you know, you look at this and you just say, come on, give us something, Jack. You know, it doesn't have to be somebody you hate or dislike, but you know you're going to have to fight somebody eventually. Call somebody out. Who do you want to fight? Who would you like to fight? Hell, man, make up some damn body. I'd like to fight Andre the Giant if he was here. That's right. I know I'm a 115-pound woman, but if Andre the Giant was here, I'd kick him outside of his big old French head and knock the eighth wonder of the world out. Why not? Anyways, Michelle Karate Heidi Watson, terrific job on her part, though. Her performance was very good, and honestly, it was one of her best showings that she showed in a long time. On the other side, for Paige VanZant, you know, it's only her second loss in her career. Still very young. She has a long ways to go as far as being successful. And one thing you got to love about her is that she's a gamer. You know, whether she loses like she did here or she wins, she is willing to come out there, put it on the line, give it everything she's got, and she's willing to say, hey, you know what, I'm not perfect. And she even said after the Rose Namajunas loss, I'm not perfect, but there's a lot I need to improve on, but that's not going to stop me. I'm going to continue to get better. I'm going to continue to push forward. I'm going to continue to strive to be the champion someday. And for someone like Paige, so young, to suffer two losses early in her career, but to still have that mindset and that upbeat energy, that says a lot about her character and about her drive and her focus to know that, hey, I can't worry about my mishaps now. Because, let's face it, people lose, okay? And Silva, Fedor, George St. Pierre, whoever, you know, you like, outside of John Jones getting disqualification, everyone loses, okay? Everybody loses. So it is what it is. Or unless you're Floyd Mayweather or Rocky Marciano. Oh, there they go. There they go. Every time I start talking about boxing, white men got to pull Rocky Marciano out their ass. That's day one. But Rocky Marciano was good. That is Joe Louis. Rocky Marciano ain't. Y'all know the rest. But sorry about that. My ADHD kicking in. So you guys got to forgive me. I got to stay on track here. Focus. Paige VanZant, though, this early in her career, to still say that upbeat. She trains at a very good gym with a very good training staff, Team Alpha Male in Sacramento. It's going to be nothing but good things for her going forward. She's definitely got to improve her stand-up as far as her punches, and she's just got to get better on her ground defense, working off of her back, working with people on her back and whatnot. And look, and when you're young, that happens. That is something that you generally will do, okay? That is something that you have to learn. You folks have to remember, you know, the trolls, as they call them on the internet. People got to remember, when you're 22 and you don't necessarily come from a jiu-jitsu background, you still have to learn the ground game. That is still a foreign territory to you. You're still learning it. You're like, okay, I kind of know this, but not everything. You know, I'm not Damian Maya. I'm not Fabricio Verdum. I'm not Jacare. I got a long ways to go. So, you know, it doesn't kill me, but it is, I guess you could say it's funny, but, you know, to see people online criticize those that do lose. It's so young in their career that they're, they're the worst thing that ever happened. They're terrible. They'll never be good fighters. Yes, they will. She will be. She'll bounce back. She'll be good going forward. Definitely look forward to seeing Paige VanZant out there once again. I told you guys that'll be a good fight to tune into. I told you. Hope you guys took my advice and tuned in. In the co-main event, that was the main event. You know what? Hold on. Let me finish up with the main event. So Michelle Waterson says she wants to get back in to the UFC cage as soon as possible. Now, the big rumor that's going around right now is Michelle Waterson taking on Rose Namajunas. Rose, obviously, you know, she got a big win against Paige VanZant. She's looking for an opponent. Michelle Waterson says, hey, you need an opponent? I'm definitely worth going out there and fighting out. Again, when would they fight? Would they want to try to throw them on one of the cards, such as, you know, UFC 208 in Brooklyn, maybe one of the fight night cards, whether it's in Phoenix or Colorado, maybe, especially Colorado, given that both Namajunas and VanZant are both fight out of Colorado. That could be the perfect scenario for those two to meet. Namajunas, after beating Paige, you know, she was riding a 3-fight win streak against Angela Hill, Paige VanZant, and Tisha Torres. But then she suffered her third loss when she lost to Carolina Kowalkiewicz back at UFC 201 in July. So she's looking to not only get back in there, but get back in the win column. That could be a very interesting matchup right there. A potential number one contender bout between the two, Karate Hardy and Nama Nunez. Very possible. Very, very possible. So look forward to that in itself. Michelle Waterson, in getting the win, she moved up from being ranked number 11 to now she's 7th. So with Nama Nunez being 4th, it definitely makes sense for those two to go at it with one another. So someone like Paige, you know, she moves down from, 7 to 9. That's okay. She, like I said, she's still young. From here, it is going to be interesting who they decide to match her up with. Do they decide to match her up with someone who fits her more stylistically? Someone that you can say, okay, you know what, it's not necessarily feeding you a scrap, a bum opponent, but we are going to try to get someone that can match you maybe skill-wise as far as what you like to do, the stand-up game. Maybe they're not a jiu-jitsu whiz on the ground just yet. Give you someone that's more along your skill range. That could be very possible. They could look at someone like Jessica Penne, who's a very good and very scrappy and very game fighter with a tremendous heart. Her matchup against Joanna Jacek, even though you want to put a hurting on her, she showed her toughness by hanging in there and not giving up. So, look, sometimes when you lose, you win as well because you just show tremendous heart and dedication and just show, I may not have the skill set or this may not be my night to beat this person, but, you know, like Rocky said against Drago, to beat me, they're going to have to kill me. So, hats off to Penny for that. She damn near did with that broken nose and all that blood that came out. Good Lord. Looked like the Kool-Aid man just poured a whole bucket on her. Valeria Letourneau from Canada, she recently just had a loss. So maybe Paige and her can go ahead, you know, coming off losses. Maybe they can face each other and get a nice scrap going there. Juliana Lima. So, I mean, there are options for Paige going forward from here. When she's back in the cage, hard to say. Again, whenever you take a loss early in a fight without any injuries, it is different for every fighter how fast they want to get back in that cage or do they want to take some time off, enjoy the holidays, which I'm sure we all will, but take that time off and get better in the area that you lost in and progress your game. Maybe she want to turn around real quick or maybe she want to take a couple of months off, not long, but a couple of months off just to go out there, sharpen up her edges, clean up the debris, and go out there and say, hey, I'm ready to get back in the cage, a better fighter. So we shall see going forward for that. For Michelle Waterson, if she wants to get back in the cage ASAP, and I mean like ASAP, there is a fight card at the end of this month, which is next Friday, UFC 207, Nunez versus Rousey for the title. On that card, Jessica Andrade, a Brazilian, Andrade, she's Brazilian, last name is A-N-D-R-A-D-E, so I'm hoping I'm saying that right, but if not, please excuse me, I'm with the public school in the inner cities, but she needs a fight, she needs an opponent, she was supposed to take on Angela Hill, but because Angela Hill was in another organization at the time, and then recently got added, and USADA is in control of the UFC testing, they do have a mandatory window that you have to be involved in their testing, and I believe it's 4 months out from your fight that you're supposed to be in their testing program, and if you're not, you just don't make that window. So Jessica Andrade definitely needs an opponent, and she's a very good fighter in her own right, holding a record of 15-5, a very good grappler, jiu-jitsu ace, very good power. I mean, she is like a little ninja turtle, ball of muscle. So she's been on the tear in her own right. So if Michelle Waterson wants to step in, hey, you didn't suffer any injuries. Maybe you can do a Cowboy Cerrone, turn it around in 2 weeks, go right back out there and take on Jessica at UFC 207 and a year with possible 2 wins. That would be a very interesting fight. So, again, there's that option, which I haven't heard too much of the possibilities of that, so that may not be there, although I would have liked to have seen that fight. But if that doesn't happen, if Van Waterson and Nama Nunez do fight, look for them to possibly be added to the UFC in Colorado card just because they're both from there. If not, shortly after the UFC 208, which will be February 11th in Brooklyn, they should definitely be scrapping sometime after that if they're not added to the Colorado or the Brooklyn card. Now, in the co-main event, we had Mickey Gauff. Hey, Mickey, you so fine. Hey, Mickey. Hey, Mickey. Was taking on Super Sage Northcutt. a.k.a. Zach Morris in some people's eyes. This was an interesting matchup because, as I said last week on the show, these are two young fighters, Sage being 22, Gall being 24. These are two young fighters who both came from Dana White looking for a fight, which you guys can look at on YouTube or on UFC Fight Pass. Interesting how they both have been perceived coming into the sport. Sage was looked at as, oh, is he like an Abercrombie model, you know, with the 8-pack abs, the spiked blonde hair, the big Kool-Aid smile, you know, the positive attitude of, hi, guys, hey, you know, all right, cool. Nothing wrong with that. I'm not knocking him for that. But that's how he was perceived, is, oh, this is a pretty boy trying to fight, even though he's been training in karate since he could probably walk. You see the pictures, 4, 5, 6 years old. He's been in karate, very athletic, very explosive, with pretty decent power. So, but, you know, do this pretty boy look, that's kind of the knock on him right now. And then for Gall, not necessarily looked at as a pretty boy, but certainly not your Bam Bam Bigelow, Brooklyn Brawler lookalike guy. So decent-looking fighter there, but he does come off with a little bit more of the edgy attitude. Like I said, when he won his first MMA pro fight, he called out CM Punk. After beating CM Punk, he called out Sage Northcutt. So he certainly has an idea of what he wants to do in his career. He has a list of fighters that he wants to fight. He's very good as far as who he wants to call out. And from when you look at both of these guys fight, they're not mere images of each other, but they are. And let me try to explain that. They're both very good in one area of their games right now in their particular careers. But those areas are opposite of each other. Sage is a very good stand-up striker. Like I said, the karate background, you can definitely see it when he's striking. He likes to jump in with that one very quick, explosive strike and then say, if I can drop you with the right hand when I come in, I'm definitely looking to get the double leg, pick you up, slam you, get you down, and that's it. If you look at Mickey Gall, his game obviously is, I want to try to come in with the right hand. If I could clip you just a little bit, then I want to try to come in, take you down to the ground, and utilize my brown belt jiu-jitsu skills to submit you. Now, Mickey Gall was able to get the submission victory here over Sage Northcutt via a rear naked choke in the second round. All four of Mickey Gall's pro wins have come via rear naked choke. Starting to sound like a female fighter who's a former champion in the UFC that was beating everybody with an armbar in her career. I believe her first 7, 8, or 9 victories came via armbar. So Mickey Gall is certainly on the way to be the male version of Ronda Rousey in the aspect that they're using one specific move to defeat you with. And, hey, if that's the case, go for it, young man. Go for it. So, but Sage really needs to improve on his ground game. Again, he's 22 years old. You know, he didn't turn pro until a couple of years ago, so he still has a long way to go as far as just learning the game, the ins and outs, the training, and becoming great at everything to be an all-around fighter. But he definitely has the tools to be there. For Mickey, he definitely has to improve in the stand-up game. And I think for this one, because his first three fights were they ended so quickly, we really didn't know what Mickey can do in the stand-up game. In this one, we got a better idea of how he is standing up, and he didn't look as comfortable as maybe he perceived himself to be, as maybe he projected himself to be. So he definitely has to go back to the drawing board, get back in there, and start working on the pad. This one, in his corner, he had Fahad Zahabi, George St. Pierre's old trainer. He had him in his corner, so I don't know if he's going to be consistently going up to Canada to work with him, and that's great if he does. He's one of the best minds in the sport, one of the best head coaches out there. Certainly would give him the training that he needs to get better as an all-around fighter. You also got Mark Henry out there in New Jersey with Eddie Alvarez, Frank Yeager, Edson Barboza. You know, Alvarez just lost. He was with Mark Henry to win the title. So there is something to say there that he's got those high-level fighters there who are good at wrestling, good at jiu-jitsu, and good at striking. Maybe Mickey could go there, split some time up there, and train with those guys. If he doesn't want to stay just in New Jersey, bring it on down to New York. Hey, you could go to Longo MMA, Longo Sarah MMA, Trevor Ray Longo in the boxing, Matt Sarah on the ground, and hey, you don't get much better than Ray Longo in the stand-up game as far as boxing, and then Matt Serra in jiu-jitsu. You don't get much better than those two guys. Kenry is a mad scientist with the way he puts combinations together and the way he trains guys. But Ray Longo is right up there as well as one of the best minds out there for coaches. Head coach of former UFC middleweight champion Chris Weidman, welterweight contender Stephen Thomas, Aljamain Sterling in the UFC bantamweight division. So he's definitely got a lot of good fighters coming out of there. So Mickey definitely has some options out there in the Northeast, whether it's in the States or up in Canada, where he can go really improve in his all-around game, especially his stand-up. But until then, hey, keep working on that jiu-jitsu. And look, if I'm him, you're always going to be looking for the submission. But, hey, go out there and perfect that rear naked choke. Make it to where you can pull that rear naked choke off from any position from the back game. And, hell, make that your signature to where you're like Ronda Rousey with the armbar. No matter what happens, if I happen to grab your neck, you're done, son. You're done. But in this particular one, and with Sage, you know, he's another one that, you know, you read and you hear the stories of is his dad. Mr. Northcutt, is he kind of hindering his son's growth as a fighter? There was a video where Sage was down in Texas sparring with a kickboxing champion, and the dad was constantly throwing instructions in, even though the kickboxer was the coach trying to, you know, show him some things. It was his dad constantly giving instructions, and even Sage at times kept having to say, hey, Dad, shut up. Hey, Dad, come on, cut it out. So you do have to wonder, is Mr. Northcutt too hands-on with his son's career? Granted, he's done a phenomenal job getting him to the UFC, getting him the way that he looks, the training, but, you know, sometimes in order to take that next step to become, to elevate your game to the next level, you kind of got to step away from what you're used to, break that mold, and get into something else. I've talked about this before, UFC 206 with Anthony Pettis and Duke Rufus MMA. Nothing against Rufus MMA, but because Pettis has been there so long, maybe he needs a change up to where he won't be somewhere where he's kind of stagnant and everything is kind of like, yeah, I know everything that we go through. So, you know, here it is. I'm just doing the same routines over and over again. Get with somebody else that's a new voice in your ear, different mindset, different outlook on how to do things, different training regimen, different sparring practices, sparring partners, different practices. So, you know, maybe something for Sage, even this young in his career, maybe that will be real good for him as well. One thing for him, and I'm not sure exactly if he's, you know, just like with Mickey Gall, I'm not sure if where he's fighting out of is where he wants to stay at. He was with Gracie. It says here, TriStar Gym. He has trained with Farhad a few times, but in this particular one, that wasn't the case. But, you know, Gracie, Barra, Caddy. So you do have to wonder, can Sage find a legit home for his MMA training camp? Because just like any other top fighter, you gotta find a legit camp that you're gonna stick with and who you're gonna grow with for at least a good period of time and see if it works out for him. So for Sage, we'll see if that happens for him. But when he got tapped out by the rear naked choke, from the angle from the front, it doesn't look like the rear naked choke is in deep. But if you look at it from the top angle, from the sky view, Mickey Gall not only has his arm right underneath the chin, it's not on the throat, but it's right underneath the chin, right? You know, if you guys put your heads up and you touch the bottom of your chin, you know, where some of us got that double chin effect going, he's got it right there and he's squeezing. Trust me, that can tap you, okay? And he's squeezing hard on that. He's got him locked up with the legs and the scissors in. Then if you also look from the sky view, Mickey Gall is leaning back to where Sage's ribs is basically giving the arrow sign pointing east. Like, yep, that way. So he's got his back bent as if he was doing a yoga stretch where he was trying to take his head and make it touch the back of his shoulders and lean up. The abdominal stretch, that's not a good feeling as well. So, again, for all the couch potatoes out there, for all the Monday morning quarterbacks who want to try to sit there, oh, well, I would have tapped or whatever, yeah, you would have. So, again, no knock on Page for Sage for tapping out. Big kudos to Mickey Gall calling out two guys in the UFC, getting those two victories. After the fight, Mickey Gall did say that he probably is going to move down to welterweight. Just figured that he's still a young buck. So, the guys at welterweight, you know, they're veterans, they're bigger guys. So he definitely wants to try to utilize his size cut down the welterweight. It might be a little different, hard cut for him, but he wants to try to be the bigger guy in the cage as he moves up. And he called out somebody that was a pretty interesting name. Everyone was wondering who he was going to call out. He called out former UFC welterweight title challenger, currently retired, Dan Hardy. Now, Dan Hardy, fighting out of England, was a very good fighter in his own right during his heyday. But what was interesting is that he called out Dan Hardy, and Dan has mentioned that he has been thinking about coming back into MMA. He has been thinking about getting back out there, fighting once again. During his time, he mostly fought at welterweight in the UFC. Very good fighter, very tough. Very good. When he fought George St. Pierre, George nearly ripped his arm off, and Dan Hardy wasn't tapping. I don't know if he's Mr. Fantastic in the arm with his joints, but he just said, "I'm not tapping." He's got very good knockout power, 25 victories, 10 losses. Of those 25 victories, 12 of them came by knockout, 9 by decision, 4 by submission. So he definitely likes to go out there and knock guys out and put a hurt on you. Of his 10 losses, only one knockout came in his career, and that was Carlos Condit. When, not to take anything away from Carlos, he's one of the most versatile strikers in MMA, but it was kind of like they were both slugging at each other, and Carlos just caught him. So not really going to hold that or knock Dan Hardy for that. He got caught. They were both throwing leather. Carlos just landed his before Hardy did. So kudos there. But, yeah, the one knockout and then his other ones, four submissions, four decisions by losses. So, Dan Hardy had to leave the sport due to injuries, unfortunately. But, in 2012, he's been an analyst, a very good analyst, by the way. If you listen to him on the TV show Inside the Octagon, he does a phenomenal breakdown, gives you kind of a scientific look at things. Like, it's not just, oh, yeah, he throws the right hand, and he's got the power in that, so boom, bam, bam, that's it. No, he really breaks it down to a science on why guys are moving this way, the footwork here, the angles and degrees. So, but he has mentioned that he is starting to feel healthy. No fighter wants to end their career due to injury. So he definitely said that he's starting to feel the itch. If he comes back, most likely it will be a lightweight at 155 pounds. If that's the case, him and Mickey Gall, that could be an interesting matchup. The old bull taking on the young buck, that'll be a pretty interesting matchup to see from there. If not, and let's say that Mickey Gall does want to fight in the lightweight division next going forward, it's much harder to move down in weight as you get older. Perfect example, look at Anthony Pettis trying to make featherweight. It's very tough for him to move down to 145 at 29 years old. Not old, but as you get older, your body just gets bigger naturally and holds more weight and fat. So for Mickey, I think, hey, if you're going to make this move, try to make it now. Go for it. He's not ready for anybody in the top 15 just yet. Still got a long ways to go. So for Mickey Gall, it is a possibility that they may have to look outside the UFC or someone who is deep, and I mean deep in their pockets on the roster to get him another fight. He still has a long ways to go. Who knows how long it'll be before either one of these fighters are back in there. Same thing with Sage Northcutt. He's fought at welterweight and at lightweight in his career. And as I said, with all the shortcomings that he has in the ground game, his two losses in MMA so far have both come by submission. He really needs to take a good amount of time off. Doesn't have to take a year off, but he definitely needs to take a good amount of time off and say, you know what, let me go out here and let me really get better at my all-around game. Let me work on my cardio. Let me work on my wrestling. Let me work on my jiu-jitsu. Let me work on my defense. And let me really come out here and look better and do a better job than just, coming out here being a one-trick pony. So it'll be interesting to see when either one of those two fighters step back in the cage. They will be fun to watch. One of the biggest storylines going into UFC Fight Night in Sacramento was the hometown kid, the California kid, Uriah Faber, calling it a career in what was, without a doubt, a Hall of Fame career, one of the best fighters during his generation. And honestly, if it wasn't for Uriah Faber during his heyday, it's very possible that the UFC may not have these smaller weight divisions. He basically carried a promotion called the World Extreme Cage Fighting, WEC. He carried them for a number of years on his back. And, with his title defenses, his style of winning, and just his personality, his persona, and his look, you know, it made you recognize that the low 155 pounds, these guys fighting at 55 and 35, there's some very good talented fighters down there, and Uriah Faber was the leading front runner for that for a number of years. But calling it a career now, you know, he's been fighting since 2003, excuse me. So 13-year career, 34 and 10. 34 of his wins came via 19 of his 34 wins came by submission. Wow. 7 knockouts, 7 decisions, so and 1 disqualification. So, you know, for this guy, the fighters that he fought during his time in the cage and just his way of going about it, always a professional, always going out there looking to push the sport, looking to make it better, always looking to put California on the map, Sacramento on the map, Team Alpha on the map, the lower weight classes on the map, and really just try to show guys that, hey, you can be a wrestler, you can be a puncher, you can be a grappler, you can be exciting, you can have personality, you can smile and do it all at the same time. Let Dominic Cruz say, hey, Team Alpha Male is nothing but guys with is CrossFitters with six-packs and bandanas. But at the end of the day, man, you know, he is one of the best fighters we've seen ever step in the cage. Just a list of some of the guys that he has fought, whether he won or lost, is irrelevant. But he's been in there with some of the best. He does Tyson Griffin is one of the guys that comes up. He does have a victory over Dominic Cruz when they first met. Jens Pulver, he has 2 victories over him. Mike Brown, unfortunately, he lost both times to him, but still 2 really good matches, especially the second one where it won fight of the night. Faber broke in both of his hands. Or was it his wrist? I can't remember if it was his hands or his wrist, but basically he had to go half the fight throwing nothing but elbows. Jose Aldo, which, look, again, he lost, but at the same time, Aldo nearly broke his leg with leg kicks, and Faber barely able to stand, kept going throughout the entire fight, did not for a decision. So hats off to him for toughing it out. And then, look, since he came into the UFC, I mean, it's been interesting. You know, he starts it off with a victory over Eddie Wineland, a very good fight with Dominic Cruz, which won fight of the night. Then he takes on Brian Balls, where he got submission of the night. You know, he got victories over Scott Jurgensen, Michael McDonald, Alex Cicero, Francisco Rivera, and Brad Pickett. One of the unfortunate things about Faber that a lot of people criticize him for is title fights outside. You know, once he lost the title to Mike Brown, he was very bad in title fights, whether it was Aldo with Dominic Cruz, Renan Barrio twice, Dominic Cruz again. You know, he lost title fight after title fight after title fight, and he even tried moving down to 135 to get a fight there. But, you know, he just wasn't successful. But nonetheless, let's not talk about his shortcomings. This is a man who was the featherweight champion at WEC with 5 successful title defenses. He won fight of the night 3 times, knockout of the night once, submission of the night 4 different times. He's got the most consecutive title defenses in the WEC with 5. And the most consecutive and most successful title defenses in WEC history with 5. Obviously, with that promotion no longer being around, no one else is going to be able to break that. He's got the most submissions in UFC bantamweight history with 6. most finishes in the UFC bantamweight division with 6. Most wins in the UFC bantamweight division with 9. Submission of the night 2 times versus Brawl, Bowles and McDonald. Fight of the night with Dominic Cruz. Once again, unfortunately, most losses in title fights with 7. Even though he went 0-7, even though he's got 7 losses, the fact that he was able to work his way up to a title fight 7 different times just goes to show you he was always in the hunt of being one of the best fighters there. So without trying to ramble on too much, but I think I might be doing already, so I apologize for that. Uriah Faber, thank you for the memories. Thank you for the action, the fights, the excitement, and thanks for everything that you brought to the sport. What was really cool, too, was afterwards when he was on the UFC on Fox panel, him and Dominic Cruz, who have one of the best, most heated rivalries in all of MMA history, they were able to shake hands. Dominic gave him the poster of their first fight card where Dominic Cruz wasn't even on the poster. And he just said, look, I signed it, but I didn't sign it in your face like I did the first time. Hey, you know, I plan on being your guy, Cody Garbrandt, in December and any other guys that you got coming from Team Alpha Male. But as far as those two, they're bygones be bygones. They're both older. They're both more mature. So that was pretty cool to see as itself because they are two of the best lower fighters, smaller fighters in MMA history, and they gave us three incredible fights to enjoy between them. So thanks, Uriah Faber, for everything. And, hey, I look forward to seeing what next in his adventures. Will he become an analyst as well? Very possible. He's got a lot of things going on in Sacramento with business, obviously Team Alpha Male. Will he become the head coach at Team Alpha Male? That'll be a pretty interesting one. Now that he could transfer and focus more of his energy there, will he now look to become one of the coaches and possibly the head coach of Team Alpha Male? That's his own gym, so you know he's not going anywhere like other coaches have in the past, so that'll be pretty cool in itself. Also, on the main card, the opening part of the main card, Alan Jobin defeated Mike Perry by decision, and this was a pretty interesting matchup. Jobin, who, you know, for some of you that may or may not remember, which is fine, Jobin, you know, he's 35 years old from Louisiana, but, you know, he's also a model on the side. So, you know, that's pretty interesting as well, that, you know, that you're a fighter, you know, kind of like Paige VanZant. You're a fighter. Your job is to get punched, kicked, knee and elbow in the face, and you're out there and you're modeling. So kudos for him, but he picks up another victory. He's now 15-4 overall in his career. 9 of his 15 victories come via knockout, so he's definitely somebody that was looking to get the finish. This is his third straight win in a row. So and he went 3-for-3 this year in the UFC. So pretty good for him stepping it up and going forward from there. So I'm very curious to see what they do with Jobin next. Going forward in 2017 in the welterweight division, obviously he's not ready to step up to the upper echelon guys, but there is a possibility. Maybe someone get like a Jake Ellenberger, Tarek Saffredin, Gunnar Nelson, Rick Story, Matt Brown, Dong Young Kim. So there is a possibility that, you know, he could get one of these guys in the top 15, bottom half of that top bottom here, that top 10, and really get some good matchups there. He's a very good striker, very accurate, got good power. He likes to utilize his range. He throws very good kicks. I like his kicks that he's able to throw out there. He throws them to the body, but then flings it up top. So, you know, what would Jobin do going forward? Again, given that he's 35 years old, I'm pretty sure he doesn't want to wait too long for in between fights if he doesn't have any injuries. I'm pretty sure that within the next fight or two, he wants to start getting top 10, top 5 guys if he's winning. He wants to try to see if he can make a run at the championship, which is, you know, again, as I said in the beginning, that's what every fighter should be doing. That's what every fighter wants to do. So it is going to be very curious to see what they do with him going forward from there. For Mike Perry, another good showing by him, able to make it through, go out there. You know, even though he lost to someone 10 years his older, still, this guy from Flint, Michigan, obviously he ain't drinking the water from Flint, but he's another very good scrapping guy. This was his first professional loss, so you know, he was 9-0 leading up to this with 9 knockouts. So, again, not somebody to sleep on whatsoever. He's not the one to sleep on, but he puts you to sleep. But now he's 2-1 in the UFC. He was trying to look for getting his third straight UFC win this year, along with his fifth overall. He wasn't able to do that. It is what it is. But Mike Perry is certainly going to be somebody that you look forward to in the future. He's still young, obviously has the power with all nine of his victories coming via knockout. So he obviously has the power to put guys out. So he just improves on his game, improves his cardio, and continues to work on his overall game. And I really believe Mike Perry is going to be a name that we hear in the future against other top guys as well going forward. Now, because he lost and Matt Brown lost, maybe those two could match up. Matt Brown's ranked number 15 right now. Maybe you could have Mike Perry and Brown scrap against each other. Maybe you want to give Mike Perry somebody a little bit lower, maybe in the top 20, top 25 of the division. You know, give him a bounce-back fight. That would certainly be reasonable. But these two guys, Jobin and Perry, even though they're 10 years different in age, definitely look forward to both of these guys stepping back in the cage going forward in their career. So definitely 2017, be on the lookout for both Alan Jobin and Mike Perry, two guys to keep an eye on. Now, I want to change up the direction here really quick, because I would be remiss if I didn't talk about this. This is an MMA show, so I keep it mixed martial arts. I talk about MMA, but from time to time, I do like to throw some boxing in there when it's worth talking about. My man working the keyboards here, Mr. James King, obviously a big-time boxing fan. He's probably forgotten more about boxing than I will ever know, but still and all,
I do look at myself as a student of the game, and one of the game, who went from being a student to a teacher, I guess you could say a master. Ain't no masters here, bro. Ain't no slaves either. Flash Dragon, come on, people, get it together. But we saw in a very hurtful yet very prideful way one of the last of a dying breed, and Mr. Bernard Executioner Hopkins calling it a career. B-Hop, the alien. It's all over. No mas. 51 years old, going on 52. No shame. But past Saturday at the Forum in L.A., Bernard Hopkins lost via 8-round knockout to Joe Smith. And, you know, it wasn't pretty. It was not pretty. Smith hit him with a very, very good combination against the ropes with a right and a left, and, you know, knocked Hopkins out of the ring. Hopkins wasn't able to grab onto the ropes when he fell. And this is weird. I don't get why none of the photographers or cameramen or anybody at the ringside doesn't try to catch these fighters. I know they're big. I know when they're falling out, they are big, heavy guys. It catches you off guard because it does happen very quick, and you are trying to get those pictures, but nobody caught him. So when he fell, he basically went head first to the ground, smacking his head on the canvas, and then from the videos I was able to look at, I don't know if he banged his ankle or when if he landed, if somebody stepped on it, or maybe it twisted as he was falling out, just because, you know, you're on the canvas, then when you're falling down, you're already going backwards, then the top half of you is going one way, so maybe his ankle just got pulled and stretched out too far, but smacked his head, messed up his ankle to where he really couldn't even walk and stand on it. Now, after the fight, Hopkins did say that he could barely stand on it, but he couldn't fight on it. And there is a difference. You know, you can stand on a bad ankle, but can you fight on it? Can you plant your feet? Can you rotate? Can you move around? And Hopkins just couldn't. Now, he said was aware that there was a 20-second rule that if a fighter in boxing gets knocked out the ring, they have 20 seconds to get back in the ring. But again, with the bad ankle, barely able to walk on it, it just wasn't there. But nonetheless, this is one of the greatest boxers to ever step in the ring, with one of the greatest stories to ever be told in the world of boxing. I seriously hope that the day comes where Hollywood, whether it's documentary, whether it's 30 for 30, whether it's a straight to DVD or a Netflix movie or even a big blockbuster movie, I hope that whenever it comes out that they do Bernard Hopkins' film correct and they tell the story in a phenomenal way. And it's not just one of those, oh, did you hear about that? No, I didn't even know that was there. I really do hope so, because this is a man that, in Bernard Hopkins, who, look, had some troubles in his youth, ended up having to go to prison, where really he learned really the love and passion for boxing. Now, from what I understand, he knew, you know, he didn't know boxing didn't exist beforehand, but in prison is really where he started to get it together and said, you know what, no matter what, I'm never coming back here. I'm never going to do it again. Comes out, and he goes on one of the greatest runs in boxing history. He finishes his career 55 wins, 8 losses. 32 of his 55 wins came by knockout. Of his 8 losses, 2 draws, 2 no contests. This is a man that fought at middleweight, light heavyweight, won the middleweight championship shortly after losing a highly anticipated fight against a young Roy Jones in the 90s, which, look, at that time, Roy Jones is just a man. You know, if you listen to a song, according to Roy Jones, B. Bernard with one hand, but that's just how good Roy Jones was. But shortly after losing to Roy Jones, he wins the middleweight championship and goes on a historic record-setting 20 straight title defenses of that title, cementing himself along with Marvin Hagler and many, many others as possibly the, in fact, in many people's minds, Hopkins and Hagler are the two greatest middleweight champions of all time. Now, they, you know, for the old timers, there could be some debate, some other names in there, but from everything that I've heard, the consensus picks is it's either Hagler or it's Hopkins. Wherever you stand on that, they never got the fight, so we'll never know. But he did make those title defenses, and during that title defense, really when he bursted onto the scene for many people was when he defeated one Felix Tito Trinidad in 2001. You know, during his time as champion, he defeated guys such as Glenn Johnson, who would later go on to knock out one Roy Jones Jr. in one of the most scary knockouts that we've seen in a long time. But when he faced Tito Trinidad in 2001, you know, this is shortly after 9/11, and it was in this middleweight tournament that was set up by Don King. And for all accounts, this was a tournament for Trinidad. This was, hey, Trinidad just beat one Oscar De La Hoya. Now, if he goes out here and he wins this middleweight championship, he can go on and face Roy Jones Jr. That was a big thing. In the first round, the first round of the tournament, Trinidad humiliates William Joffe, who was a very good fighter, but just not on Trinidad's level. So now you're taking on Trinidad and Hopkins. Hopkins was good. You know, okay, he's got these nice title defenses, but, you know, they're not against the Trinidads or the De La Hoyas, et cetera, et cetera. So he wasn't getting the credit that he deserved. He wasn't getting the respect that he deserved. And, again, at 36 years old, many people felt that the younger, more powerful hitting Trinidad was the favorite. And everyone was looking at Trinidad versus Jones. Even Roy Jones was there at ringside hoping that Trinidad would be able to dismantle Hopkins so that those two can fight. Hell, I was in high school. I was a Trinidad fan. I was a Roy Jones fan more, but I was a Trinidad fan since the early 90s. So I was rooting for Trinidad. I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to try to sit here and fake the phone. I won't lie to you people. But Hopkins in Madison Square Garden put on a beatdown clinic of one Felix Trinidad that till this day people are still in awe of. Because at 36 years old, for someone who, yeah, you're good, but you haven't beaten none of the elite guys yet. You didn't beat Roy Jones when you had a chance. You haven't fought these young, powerful hitters like Trinidad and whatnot. So what you going to be able to do, Hopkins? For Hopkins to be able to go out there and dismantle Trinidad and finish him off with a TKO in the 12th round, it was jaw-dropping. It was amazing. And really opened people's eyes and say, this guy ain't that bad. He's not that bad. He's actually pretty damn good. He put on a – and one thing about Hopkins' style was, you know, he was a boxer. He wasn't a brawler. He wasn't a puncher. But he was a mix of a boxer and a brawler without necessarily the full knockout power. But Hopkins liked to make the fight dirty. And I don't necessarily mean, you know, lace your eyes with the inside of his glove or like in the movie Gladiator, the boxing movie with Cuba Gooding Jr. You know, he puts some type of a substance on his gloves and rubs in your eyes that you can't see, and then comes in there and hits you. Now, not things like that, but, you know, he likes to grapple with you, likes to clinch on you, likes to push on you, likes to lean on you, likes to bully you a little bit, throw a little shoulder at you, move his head while he's in the clinch, and, you know, not necessarily like throw a headbutt, but, you know, you move the head, bam, you know, I'm clipping you a little bit with this noggin I got. He likes to make it dirty. And what he would do is it would frustrate a lot of fighters and it would stop their momentum either from coming forward or throwing their big wound-up punches. And that was something that Trinidad couldn't figure out. Every time he tried to come in and come forward, Hopkins would either time up or get inside and just pop, 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 pop. And then every time Trinidad was trying to load up, if he didn't already throw the punch, Hopkins was tying them up and keeping it close to where Trinidad couldn't get his momentum going forward, couldn't wind up for the big punches, and just frustrated him and flustered him throughout the night, and he was able to finish him off, so it was impressive. From there, a couple more title defenses, one over William Joffe, but then another one that really cemented him as an all-time great. It cemented his legacy, so to speak, was when he finally got the quote-unquote the big fight in boxing, Oscar De La Hoya, 2004. Oscar was not a middleweight. But, you know, he was generally a welterweight and lower. But he wasn't a middleweight. But Oscar, to his credit, was willing to fight the best of the best. Who am I supposed to face? Got it. I'm facing him. He moved up to middleweight, took on Hopkins in 2004. And, well, he learned real quick. You can have all the heart you want. The size, power, and outmatch. Hey, this ain't going to be my night. And Hopkins was able to get a stunning KO knockout with a body punch over De La Hoya. It was amazing because, you know, even De La Hoya said, it was one of those body punches he's taken 1,000 times before. But, you know, we notice in fighting, right time, right, an inch to the left, an inch to the right, a little bit high, a little bit no, and it's over. Same thing with taking a punch on the jaw. You know, sometimes, hey, I've taken a lot of uppercuts or a lot of crosses that would just call me at the right at the right spot, and that's what happened here. When Oscar De La Hoya went to the ground with that body shot, he was holding his rib, and just it was almost like you thought, man, did he have a broken rib? Did he fracture his rib? It was just one of those things that just, you know, it had a jolt of life into his body with a lot of sharp pain. And Hopkins from there, you know, really cemented himself and said, hey, what I did to Trinidad 3 years ago was no fluke. Okay, I'm 39 years old, and I just knocked out the Golden Boy. So what I did then was not no fluke. And then from there, you know, he made his historic 20th defense against Howard Eastman from England. But then, you know, he had a very good duel with Jermaine Taylor with two very close bouts. The first one was via split decision that went Taylor's way, controversial, but then turned right around. In the same year, they went at it again. Taylor won. And then people thought, okay, well, you know what? At 40 years old, Hopkins just doesn't have it anymore. Jermaine Taylor is the new blood. Hopkins is the old. And Hopkins said, oh, really? He moves up to light heavyweight and says, yeah, I'm going to move on up, and I'm going to take on your champion. And that was, at the time, one Antonio Tarver, who had knocked out Roy Jones Jr. in their second fight. In their first fight, he gave Roy all the trouble he could handle and nearly pulled off the big upset. But in the second fight, he got his redemption with a controversial decision that went Roy Jones' way the first time and knocked out Roy Jones this time. And he said, and he's just coming off the Rocky Balboa movie with Sylvester Stallone, so his profile was very high. And his profile was high, and boy, so was his chin, because Hopkins found a place for it every single time he threw the right hand. I mean, this was another one of his performances, and this time it's at 41, where it just made you say, what does this guy drink? What is in his water? What does he eat? What is up? Because at 41 years old, he looked faster. Not necessarily stronger, but his timing was tremendous. His ring savvy was superb. His ring awareness was on top of anybody in the time. It almost looked like this guy hasn't lost his stuff. And at 41 years old, that's not something you say about most fighters. And then he wins a light heavyweight championship. Then he beats Winky Wright. So now you're saying, well, shoot, now is he going to make another run at light heavyweight like he did at middleweight in his 40s? Fortunately, he runs into Joe Calzaghe, who, you know, was one of the best fighters during his era as well. Like Rocky Marciano, retired undefeated. But it was a split decision, so it's not like it was a one-sided beatdown. But then he turns right around, and at 43 years old, that same year he lost to Calzaghe, he puts on the clinic on Kelly Pavlik. And Pavlik, who was the young Ohio power-hitting guy from a blue-collar town, tremendous punching power, and Hopkins just put a beatdown on him. Get the decision over him. Later on, in 2010, as we fast forward, he gets the rematch. Long, long awaited. In fact, if I could just go down real quick here, this was Roy Jones Jr. and Bernard Hopkins first fought each other May 22nd in 1993 when Hopkins was 28 years old. Roy is 2 years younger, so Roy Jones was either 24 or 25 at the time. But he was around that age. They didn't fight again until April 3rd, 2010. Nearly 20 years later, they fight each other. 17 years in the making, they've been trying to make this rematch. Now, regardless of who you want to believe, whether it was Hopkins holding it up, Roy holding it up, they were in two different weight classes. Roy had moved up to light heavyweight while Hopkins was making his middleweight run. They just never could come to agreement to meet each other until now. And they fought each other, obviously shells of them old selves. It wasn't the most spectacular fight, but it definitely showed that as they got older, Roy Jones certainly lost a step or two, while Hopkins potentially gained a step or two. So he was able to defeat the man who first gave him who beat him early in their career in a high-profile match, and he was able to kind of, you know, say, hey, I got you one back. He gets a draw, and he goes with a 1-0-1 against John Pascal, and in one of the fights, for the light heavyweight championship. In one of the fights, in their second go-around, he put on another clinic, you know, doing the wind-up with the right hand and throwing the right hand, you know, kind of standing sideways, shucking and jiving with the shoulders and pop, 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 pop. And at 46 years old, looked faster than ever, looked like he was on par to just say, man, this guy can go forever, it seems like. And so he was able to get Pascal. Then against Chad Dawson, another very good boxer, he went 0-1-1 against a no contest and then the loss in that one. you know, that necessarily wasn't a one-sided beatdown, but it certainly showed that, you know, in this particular fight, just like Jermaine Taylor, Dawson just had the skill set that is just better than Hopkins at that time. He just was able to beat him. But then he rallied off three in a row, from 2013 to 2014. He was able to rally off three straight victories. Then he ran into, in 2014, a man by the name of Sergey Kovalev. At 49 years old, he took on the Russian power puncher, losing the WBA Super and the IBF Light Heavyweight Championship. And look, as I said for the Andre Ward fight, you know, Sergey Kovalev is one of the best fighters out there. Boxers, punchers, brawlers, it doesn't matter. He's one of the best out there and one of the hardest punchers out there. So when Hopkins lost to him at 49 years old, people certainly looked at it and said, well, you know, age is starting to catch up to him. You know, he, you know, didn't look the same, but it's against one of the best fighters out there, so maybe not so much. For one reason or another, Hopkins took he took 2 full years off. Didn't fight again from 2014 to 2016 this past weekend. Came back at 51 years old looking to make it, hey, my last go-around, my last hurrah. Unfortunately, it wasn't successful, losing to Joe Smith Jr. We'll see what Smith can do as far as making that into a career. But with all that being said, Hopkins is one of the best minds, even at 52 years old. You know, when you hear him do interviews and whatnot, he doesn't talk. You know, he's not slurring his words. He's still sharp and quick-witted. You know, he's a partner there at Golden Boy Promotions. You see him up there with fights, you know, trying to promote it. So he's an analyst at times. So he certainly has himself set up for life after boxing in a good way. But for 67 total fights in his pro career, multiple championships across the middleweight and light heavyweight division, countless big-name fights, and tremendous performances. You know, Bernard Hopkins, man, was one of the best to watch, one of the funnest to watch. And just to give you an idea of how his numbers look, his first big numbers fight was against Trinidad in 2001. That had 475,000 buys, revenue of over $20 million. De La Hoya, million buys, $56 million. Taylor, 370,000, next one, 410. Tarver, 330. The second one with Jones, 157 million. That was his lowest one. Again, their age, the fact that, you know, Jones hadn't been looking the same. And to be honest, I just think that the promotion behind it just wasn't that good. I remember being very excited for that fight. The promotion behind it just wasn't that good going forward. So I certainly was a bit disappointed that they didn't do more for that fight going forward. But nonetheless, Bernard Hopkins, one of the greatest to ever fight, the executioner, B-Hop, from Philadelphia, thank you for the memories. Thank you for the entertainment. Thank you for the performances. And thanks for going out there, being a true professional, being a warrior, going out there and putting on a show for the fans through all these years. I can't thank you enough, man. Hopefully one day I get to meet you in person and be able to thank you personally. But honestly, guys, we should all definitely appreciate what Bernard Hopkins was able to do for us as a fighter as far as entertaining us. Now, that's the boxing portion of it. Maybe a bit long, but hey, it's inside the octagon. Let's get back to that thing. Coming up next week is UFC 207. So, obviously, next week's show, the 26th, the day after Christmas, I'm going to be right here talking with you guys about this, that event. Hopefully, I'm able to have either pro MMA fighter Dominique Robinson, a.k.a. the Fallen Angel. Hopefully, I can have him on with me. He's one of the best minds in the game. I've had a chance to listen to this brother on MMA Junkie Radio, which you guys can listen to on SiriusXM Channel 93 Rush at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Be sure to check those guys out. Tremendous what George and Goes do out there for MMA Junkie. So big shout out to them. Be sure to check them out. But Dominique Robinson, he has a spot on there being a co-host, I think once a month or twice a month. I'm not sure because he just got back from overseas. But, you know, he's known as Greg Blackston due to his mindset and how he looks at and sees the fight game. So certainly look forward to checking him out. You guys can look him up on YouTube at Fallen Angel 510. And if you look there, you'll see myself along with Dominique Robinson and also our other co-host, Spillbag of Ice, where we were doing three straight G's MMA podcast shows where we were breaking down the fights earlier this year and last year. So even though they're old, if you guys kind of want to get an idea of Dominique Robinson's mindset over the game, and you want to check out this stunning handsome guy, be sure to go to Fallen Angel 510 on YouTube and check out Three Straight G's, or go to YouTube, type in Three Straight G's, and you'll be able to see us there. We're in a garage with the background King Mixon. So it's some good stuff there. So hopefully I have him on. I'm also looking to have Marissa Rivers on the show as well, hopefully before the year ends out. If not, certainly at the beginning of the year. Marissa Rivers, she's a director or a production manager at SiriusXM Channel 93 Rush. Guys, let me tell you, I've listened to her for a couple of years that I've been listening to SiriusXM. She is one of the best analysts. I notice I didn't say women. She is one of the best analysts and fighters on there. She definitely knows what she's talking about. She definitely has a lot of passion for the fight game and definitely can throw down with anybody as far as breaking down and talking about fighters and fights coming in the past. So definitely looking forward to having her on here as well. So be on the lookout for those episodes. I'm looking to get more people on here. So guys, if you know any fighters out there or any managers, any head coaches, trainers, or even if yourself, if you want to get on here on Inside the Octagon, chop it up with me, do an interview, do some questions, recap or break down a card coming up, please get in contact with me via Twitter at KLUA11. That's KLUA11. Do that. We can definitely chop it up, and we can definitely set something up going in the future from there. So definitely be on the lookout. I would like to get some guests on the show more often in 2017. Didn't want to do it in 2016 because I kind of wanted to see where things would be going from here. But in 2017, I definitely want to up the ante on things. So be on the lookout for that. But to end out the year, we got UFC 207. So I'm gonna get into that show all next week. So don't worry. What I want to get into real quick is a little bit of a recap of 2016. But before I get into that, I want to just cover real quick this Conor McGregor, Floyd Mayweather stuff. And I know it could be a little bit old, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. I just want to go over it real quick. I don't believe there's an MMA fighter out there that can beat a championship-level boxer. And I don't believe there's a championship-level – I don't believe there's a boxer that can go out there and compete against a championship-level mixed martial artist. They're just two different worlds. But I will say this. Regardless of Floyd Mayweather – not if he wins, but how he wins. Regardless of that, who's another name in boxing that you would be excited for if Floyd Mayweather said, "I'm coming back"? He didn't say an opponent, but he said, "I'm coming back. I'm going after number 5-0. Who would you be excited for him to fight? And I'm being real. Be realistic. I don't want to hear Deontay Wilder or Andre Ward. No, be realistic. Do you really want to see Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao too? Sure. If you're a Manny Pacquiao fan, you certainly want to see it. You know, the bad shoulder, the poor performance. Some people, for some reason, thought Manny Pacquiao won. Sure, okay, I see that. But for a casual fan, for Mayweather fans, do you really want to see that? I'll tell you what, I didn't try and pay $100 for it again. No, sir. Fool me once, fool me twice, no, sir. Okay, Terrence Crawford ain't up there. Adrian Broner's been slipping. Beat Maidana, beat Canelo already. Plus, Canelo, you know, he's trying to worry about Triple G right now. Maybe Triple G, but now apparently he's scheduled to take on Danny Jacobs, which I think that's going to be a hell of a fight. Keith Thurman, okay. Young guy, powerful, knockouts, big enough, undefeated, big enough name. No. Sean Porter, a lot of heart, charisma, tough guy. Certainly brings it. Beat Adrian Broner, big enough name. No. Amir Khan, glass jaw, definitely likes to talk a big game. Has the fans from England behind him. Okay, maybe, but he just got knocked out. Name, okay. Cotto, well, no, he's taking on James Kirtland. So maybe if Cotto beats Kirtland, maybe he's old. You know, getting up there, losing a little bit of a step. You know, he's with Freddie Roach, that rivalry of Mayweather Sr. and Roger Mayweather and Freddie Roach. Okay, maybe, but I beat him already. So, who's going to fight? Danny Garcia, undefeated, got the hair, got the dad that talks a lot of shit. But he's got to also fight Keith Thurman. And big enough name, you know. So think about it. Who in boxing right now is worthy of being Floyd Mayweather's comeback fight? When you fought Andre Berto, that did not do well for pay-per-view buys. One, it was a backlash of the Manny Pacquiao fight that a lot of people felt was boring, not entertaining, didn't live up to the 5-year build-up hype that it had behind it, the price tag for not only tickets there, but also paying for it, did not live up to the hype. They didn't want to see either one of those guys again. In fact, both Manny Pacquiao's fight as well, after the Mayweather fight, that didn't do the good numbers either. So, okay, fans maybe don't want to see Mayweather fight unless it's against a big-name guy. Who's bigger right now than Conor McGregor in the fight game? He's got the charisma, he's got the trash-talking ability, he's got the mystique about him, and he's got that mystery of, well, he's got that left-hand power. Now, with 4-ounce gloves, that's different than 10, 12, 16-ounce gloves. That's different. But still, if he can land that left on Floyd, who knows? Floyd has struggled with southpaws before in the past. Who knows? It wouldn't happen, but still, the wonder is there. So I'll just say this. If this fight was to happen, the end result may be what we all know it would be, and it may not be worth watching, but the build-up to it would certainly be one of the best that we've ever seen. Remember when Mayweather made his name on 24/7 when he fought Oscar De La Hoya, when he took on the Money Mayweather moniker? That's what blew him up. And that's what helped save boxing. And that's really what made 24/7 and Showtime shows. And that's what made all the Mayweather fights since then, the Hoyer one, must-see TV. So, that's what McGregor has done in the UFC. He's made every fight that he does must-see with everything he does, not just his fighting, but the trash-talking, the suits, the Gucci Mink jacket, the getting in your face, the quick lines that he has. So, the build-up would certainly be something that everyone will be interested in and certainly would get everyone excited for and interested in. So, again, I would love to see it happen, but if it does, I'm 99.9% clear of what the end result will be. But I think the build-up would be better than any we've seen in a long time. So, just something to think about. Wrapping up the show here on Inside the Octagon, let's talk a little bit about 2016. I mean, this was a hell of a year. Last year, we thought, man, the title changed hands, what, that 6-7 times? Woo, how does it top it? Well, I'll tell you how it tops it. It tops it by changing hands multiple times this year. For the title, I'm going to go over the title fights where the title changed hands. We had Dominic Cruz getting his title back because he never lost it. He just had to give it up to injuries. But he won the Bantamweight Championship from TJ Dillashaw earlier this year in January. Misha Tate won the Women's Bantamweight Championship from Holly Holm via rear naked choke in the fifth round of a fight that many felt Holly Holm was winning, but then Holm put her to sleep. Wowzers. Stipe Miocic wins the Heavyweight Championship after knocking out Fabricio Verdum in Brazil in the first round. I mean, that was a very good knockout by Stipe. Verdum was rushing him, coming forward. Stipe just stepped off to the right hand. Oh, yeah, the last one with a right hand that put Verdum to sleep in his home country of Brazil. So, very surprising that Miocic was able to make it out of there. Nothing against the Brazilians, but they are very passionate. So, kudos to him for that one. Michael Bisping pulled off one of the biggest upsets when he stepped in on late notice and knocked out Luke Rockhold first round of their matchup at UFC 199. I mean, these two have fought each other before, and Rockhold beat Bisping. So going into this one, it was supposed to be Rockhold, Weidman 2 for the title, but Weidman got injured. Bisping steps in on like 12 days notice, I believe, and was it 21 days? I get the 21 is mixed up. Either one, it was short notice. But Bisping was able to come in there confident, says, "Hey, I beat Anderson Silva early this year. I'm in good shape. I'm ready to go out there and prove that your first win over me was a damn fluke." And he knocks out Luke Rockhold. Now Luke obviously looked a little cocky in the fight, was a little like 2 days ago, underestimated Bisping. So he certainly had a lot to learn from that loss right there. We haven't seen Luke back in the cage because he got injured recently. But Bisping certainly looked at one of his best in that fight and winning the belt that he'd been chasing for 10 years. So kudos to him. Eddie Alvarez captured a lightweight championship against Rafael Dos Anjos with a first-round TKO at UFC Fight Night 90 during the International Fight Week. I mean, he came in on a two-fight winning streak. And he just blasted Dos Anjos. RDA early in the year was supposed to go ahead and fight Conor McGregor, but he got injured, had to pull out. That was an Nate Diaz victory over McGregor the first time. So then Rafael was trying to bounce back and say, look, man, I need to get back up there and get my profile up again. You know, I won this title from Anthony Pettis. I defended against Cowboy Cerrone. I got to get back out there and let people know who I am, that I am the champion. No. The Philadelphia kid, the underground king, Eddie Alvarez was not out of it. So kudos to Eddie Alvarez for getting his first UFC championship. Didn't hold on to it for too long, but we'll get to that later. Amanda Nunes, then she wins the Women's Bantamweight Championship with a first-round submission of her own, also via Real Naked Choke, over Misha Tate. Now, since Holly Holm beat Ronda Rousey for the title in November, then she loses it to Misha Tate. Then Misha Tate loses it to Amanda Nunes. I mean, Rousey, that belt has been passed around like a hot potato. We'll see if UFC 207, if it'll be passed back to Ronda Rousey or if Amanda Nunes be able to hold on. In this fight, you could say that this was Amanda Nunes putting Misha Tate into her retirement. She broke her nose in a very brutal fashion with a mean right. And, you know, many wonder if Misha Tate knows that healed from that correctly to go forward in her career. But she was very bloody, looked a hot mess. And then Amanda Nunes, being a high-level grappler, she put the rear naked choke on, got her first championship belt in the UFC, and becomes the first Brazilian female to win a UFC title. So kudos to Amanda Nunes on making history there. Tyron Woodley defeated Robbie Lawler for the welterweight championship with a first-round KO. Robbie Lawler had made a couple title defenses of his belt. He had a resurgence in his career since coming back to the UFC. Now that he was down in Florida training with American Top Team, he had the cardio to go with his power. He sharpened up his brawling tactics from his earlier days to really become more technical with his striking. Still, you know, he would have brawler moments, but he wasn't as wild like he was before, just throwing haymakers. And he really became a fan favorite, someone who put on classic bouts against Johnny Hendricks, against Roy McDonald, against Carlos Condit. So, yeah, it was very, very fun to watch. That in itself going forward, but Woodley was able to stop him and claim his first UFC championship with a first-round KO, and really surprised a lot of people with the way that he was able to knock him out. But, hey, if you got power, anything can happen. And then Conor McGregor made UFC history when he wins his second consecutive belt in the UFC when he defeated Eddie Alvarez for the lightweight championship at UFC 205 last month in the second round with a TKO. So you guys already know what that is, so I don't need to go over it more, but kudos to him on that. Now, obviously, we did have some interim championships in there. John Jones became the interim champion over Ovince St. Preux. Jose Aldo became the interim champ over Frankie Edgar. And now we have Max Holloway as the interim champ after he defeated Anthony Pettis at 206. So, you know, but I don't like to count the interim championships. I will say this, and I pose this question to you guys. Should the UFC just make the interim championship a belt in the promotion? Look, I'm not saying make it like boxing where, you know, you have a division, but you have like four, five, six different belts, and you don't really know who the true champion is. No, but should you have the champion, and then should you have the interim champion? You know, whether that's the number one ranked contender or whatever, should you have that belt as well? Because we've seen in some divisions, like do you take the UFC flyweight division with Demetrius Johnson? You got fighters like Joseph Benavidez, who has beaten everyone in that division besides Demetrius Johnson, who he's lost to twice already for the title. So then you got to wonder, do we continue to give him title shots until either he can defeat Demetrius Johnson or Demetrius leaves the division? Or do we just say, hey, you know what, we're going to make you an interim champion, and we're going to say, you know what, you can defend this belt until whenever, and then you work your way up. I don't know, but let me know what you guys think. Does the UFC need to incorporate a permanent interim championship belt in all the divisions? You got two championship belts. I mean, you got two champions in the division. If it matches up, you can have champion versus champion. If the card is not that strong, you can have two titles on the line on these cards as well. That'll certainly raise the profile of a lot of these fight cards that aren't necessarily up there as far as some of the other ones. And then for these ones on UFC Fight Night, on UFC Fight Pass, you got the interim champion defending on those. Again, give it a high profile to get more people to tune in. So that's something I would certainly like to know from you guys. So get back to me on Twitter at KLua11, that's KLUA11, and let me know what you guys think. Should the UFC have permanent interim champions throughout the division? I am very curious about that, and I'd love to debate it with you guys going forward. Here's a question I want to pose to you guys. Again, I'd love to hear your answers on Twitter at KLua11, that's KLUA11. Who's your fight of the year for 2016? Is it Conor McGregor, who went 2-1 with victories over Nate Diaz and Eddie Alvarez? Again, he moved up to take on Nate Diaz at welterweight when he was 145-pound champion. So moving up 30 pounds, going 1-1 against one of the toughest fighters in the sport, not bad. And then making history by becoming the third fighter to win two belts in two different divisions, but the first fighter to win two belts at the same time and holding two belts at the same time and being a featherweight and lightweight champion with his victory at UFC 205. And then with all three of his fights, record-setting numbers for each one. So he certainly has some claim to it. What about Stipe Miocic winning the heavyweight championship, bringing another title to Cleveland, doing it in Brazil, and then coming home and defending his title in Cleveland against Alistair Overeem, defeating two of the best heavyweights in MMA history in Stipe Miocic and Alistair Overeem. He certainly has some claim to that title. Or what about Dominic Cruz coming back after, what, close to 4 years of being off and only having one fight in that time? Defeating TJ Dillashaw for the title, defending it against his rival and closing out their chapter against Gerard Faber, and now he closes out the year against Cody Garbrandt. Again, I know if he loses, I can definitely knock him out of there, but if he wins 3-0, won the title, defended it twice, Dominic can certainly put his name up there. What about Joanna Jędrzejczyk? Defending the title this year several times, certainly looks to be head and shoulders above everyone else in the division. Had a very tough outing decision against Carolina Kowalskiewicz at UFC 205. So Joanna certainly looking like, hey, she is the queen of that UFC strawweight division, and she's not giving up that belt anytime soon. What about Michael Bisping? 3-0 this year, defeated the legend, the GOAT, Anderson Silva, earlier this year in his hometown of England. That was his story, considering how long he had been wanting to fight the Spider. Then on short notice, gets the upset victory over Luke Rockhold, claiming a title he had been chasing for 10 years, and then getting revenge over the man who gave him one of the most brutal knockouts in MMA history, Dan Henderson. This year, 3-0, Bisping certainly could claim some fame to that title as well for Fight of the Year. So who do you guys think will be Fight of the Year? Would it be McGregor, Miocic, Cruz, Joanna, Bisping, someone else? Let me know on Twitter at KLua11. Fight of the Year, Lawler, Condé, Dillashaw, Cruz, McGregor, DS2, Bisping, Silva, Swanson, Chow. My gosh. Good options there. Who do you guys think it should be going forward? What about KO of the Year? Miocic over Verdum, Bisping over Rockhold, Rodriguez over Feely when he hits him with the jump kick, throws the right leg, but then hits him with the left to the face, knocking him out that way. Wowzers. Cerrone over Mack Brown, left high kick to the head. What about Romero over Weidman? Flying knee to the side of the head, putting him to sleep. All of those are certainly worth it. What about Submission of the Year? Ben Rothwell choking out Josh Barnett, which nobody saw happening. Misha Tate putting Holly Holm to sleep, making her punch the air. Diaz handing Conor McGregor his first UFC loss with a rear naked choke in the first round. Damian Maia clearly making easy work of Carlos Condit with the rear naked choke. Or was there another submission that you saw that you liked this year? Let me know all of this on what you think on Twitter at KLua11. Thank you guys for tuning in. This was a special episode of 90 Minutes of Inside the Octagon. Thanks, James, for this opportunity, and thanks for giving me this chance to speak what I love to follow, what I love to watch, and what I love to talk about MMA. Certainly look forward to hearing from you guys throughout the week. You guys have a good one. Again, follow me on Twitter at KLua11, that's KLUA11. Also, follow my sports page on Facebook, All Things Sports. That's All Things Sports on Facebook. Tune in next week for another episode of Inside the Octagon and Thursday for the Sports Crib from 6 to 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Until then, y'all take care and have a good one. Hey, I'm outie. Peace.